Matt Roberts is an associate professor in the Department of Agriculture, Environmental, and Development Economics at The Ohio State University. He's also an Extension State Specialist there. Prior to going back to grad school, Matt worked as a commodity and energy derivatives broker and also worked as a market research consultant with the pharmaceutical industry in North Carolina, and probably, although it's not our topic of the morning, can provide us some interesting insights about the whole healthcare discussion. And he's been at Ohio State University since 2001. Well, Matt, I'm going to turn it over to you then for your slide presentation, and I'll be back to interact with you at the end of it with some questions from our audience. So, Matt, go ahead, kind of create the context in the grain area for us.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that introduction, John, and thank you to Duane for doing the technology here, and thank you to the Western RME Center for putting this on. I think this is a format of presentation that is really open some great opportunities, and I'm excited to be here and take part. What I want to talk about today, obviously the title of the talk, is what are today's grain markets telling us about the future? So I want to talk obviously about grains, but I think before one can even really talk too much about grain markets, one has to talk a little bit about the petroleum market, about energies, and also about then we'll talk about petroleum to set up the grain markets. We'll talk about grains, starting with global supplies and the global outlook before moving to the U.S. We'll talk about biofuels, and I want to finish up talking about what I actually think in the long term may be one of the biggest issues facing the grain markets right now, and that is one of the biggest issues facing grain markets right now, and that is H.R. 2454, the Waxman-Markey, or this cap and trade bill. So I'm going to work through each of these. When we start, you know, the reason I start with the oil market is quite simple. Right now, the corn market is very influenced. I don't think this is a surprise to anybody, but the corn market is very influenced by ethanol market and by biofuels. And if you want to know what's going to happen to biofuels, you need to know what's going to happen to gasoline prices. If you want to understand gas prices, you got to start at petroleum. And so this is just a chart. On this chart, the I hope my cursor is showing up here. This green line at the top is Chinese economic growth from 1990 to present, year over year percentage change. The blue line is world economic growth, and the black line is, the black line's world, the blue line is U.S. economic growth. The red line is red. The red line is oil use, change in oil use. And the reason I start with this is, although we hear so much about how much the increase in the third world, what impact that has had on overall economic or overall oil prices, when you look at this, although you can see some similarities between Chinese growth and the other growth, realistically, if you look at changes in oil use, that red line, it doesn't track as closely with that green line as it does with the black line. And really, that black line is the world economic growth. If you want to know what's going to happen to oil prices or to the consumption of oil, it's all about the world economy. It's not about China. It's not about India. It's not just about the U.S. It's about world economic growth. And what you see is up through 2004, 2005, they were very tightly coupled together. World economic growth and oil use were very tightly coupled together. Then, as basically economic growth from the world outstripped the oil market's ability to supply additional oil to the market, That's when we started to see that oil use drop off. And then eventually in 08, 09, we saw a real decline in world economic growth that actually, in a sense, almost caught up with that decline in world oil use. When we look at, this is a graph of world liquid fuel consumption. There's three different categories here. That darkest blue color you see is Chinese. Each year, how much liquid fuel does it use? What's the change in their liquid fuel? And what you see is, although yes, Chinese liquid fuel from 2002 to 2010, every year their total liquid fuel consumption increases. The darker green color there is the United States, and what you see is actually over this same time period, net, if we added this all up together, if we add this all up together, the U.S. consumption has actually declined from 2002 to 2010, while the rest of the world generally has grown. And so these are, again, you can't simplify this into, oh, this is because of China or because of India or because of the United States. There's a lot of things all going together in the overall oil market. Now, if you want to know where oil prices are, the single best statistic for oil prices, I'm sorry for the pauses. We keep popping back and forth here, the presenters do. The single best oil price, or kind of characteristic of what's going to set oil prices, is this graph right here. And what this graph shows is in OPEC, in the OPEC countries, how much more oil they could be producing than they currently are. Okay? And so as we go along from, you know, this starts in 98, from 98 to 2002, the OPEC countries could produce another 3 to 5 million barrels per day of oil. Now you see that gray line right there? That's 2.8 million barrels. That's considered kind of an important cut point. If we have more than 2.8 million barrels of extra capacity, basically it provides a lot of reassurance to the market. Now you can see starting in 03, 03 through 08, the amount of extra pumping capacity that OPEC has, and the reason we only talk about OPEC is really the rest of the world is always producing at its maximum level. You don't hear about the United States suddenly deciding, prices are low, we're going to cut production. The rest of the world is pretty much producing as much oil as it can. It's OPEC that has that excess capacity and that actually uses that excess capacity. So 03 to 08, very tight markets. You go back to 04 and you see 04 and 05, maybe a million barrels per day. And this, to put in context, during this time period we were using about 80 to 82 million barrels a day. So maybe only an extra 1 to 1.4% capacity. So this would be, you know, the equivalent of having 40 million bushel carryout in corn or something along those lines. Very, very small carryouts is the equivalent of this. Now, as you can see, from 05 was the low point. 06, 07, 08, what's happening there is that rise, and especially in 9 and 10, is that we are seeing, we have seen some oil, especially in 08, 9, 10, come into production, some new fields, some new wells come into production, but obviously a lot of this is driven by global demand weakening down to meet that excess. But the key point here is with 9 and 10 having lots of excess production capacity, we should be a little more immune to the spikes and the vagaries of the oil market as prices change. Or as demand changes, it should buffer us from big changes in supply. So when we look at the futures markets, what we see is oil prices really from current out to about 2012 are right around $80 per barrel. Okay, from now to about 2012 are right about $80 per barrel. And the market seems very comfortable with that. Depending on what's going on, if one of these hurricanes does start to grow and move into the Gulf, you'll see these prices move up on the nearby. But as we look even farther out, the farthest out, the futures markets in oil trade out right now to December 2017, and the highest we see out there is about $94, $95. And so the market seems very comfortable in this range. It's a range that continues to disincentivize extreme amounts of usage, but yet it provides a high enough price to incentivize continued exploration, continued production. You know, and to realize why that's important, you may have seen last week British Petroleum announced that they found a new, very, very sizable oil reservoir in the Gulf of Mexico, very, very deep water. All told, I believe it's something on the order of 35,000 feet below the surface, a combination of water and rock that has to be drilled through. They need prices of $70 per barrel to make that profitable to bring that oil to the surface. So this price right here, a good balance to incentivize that continued exploration, very expensive exploration. At the same time, high enough, hopefully, to discourage a few of our sons and daughters from driving aimlessly around the square on Friday night. So that sets the oil stage. I think this $75, $85 per barrel is an area that the market's comfortable in the big picture. So now let's turn to global supplies. This is the global wheat market. And what you see here, there's basically two components of this graph that I want to highlight. So I don't want the whiteboard. I want a pointer. Here we go. Let's try this. There's my little pointer. Okay. So at the top, this red line right here shows total global production. Okay, global production, a million metric tons global of wheat. I'm sorry, of use, total use. The white line is total production. Okay, is total global production. And then these red bars at the bottom, those are stocks use ratios. So in other words, at the end of each year, take the amount that's still in storage and divide it by total use. So we go back here to 2007, we had about a 20%, 19.4, 20% stocks use. We had total use that year of about 600 million metric tons, so that means we had about 120 million metric tons in storage at the end of the year. And what you see as you go back across this graph is, you know, 20% is extremely low. It was the lowest since the 40s. And that's what gave us, that's what set the stage for that big run-up in 2008. But since then, look what happened to production. That year we produced right at about 600 million metric tons. Our total use was actually about 612 million metric tons. Then production, global production went from 600 to 680 million metric tons from one year to the next. About a 13% increase. Now it's declined down to about 656 this year, but still very large production. Use has only increased much more slowly, and that's allowed these global wheat inventories to increase up to 26.2, up to 28.4%. And the reason this matters is wheat is a good single summary statistic of the global feed grain market. Wheat is a primary feed grain around the world, and it's a good indicator that feed grain supplies are returning to much more normal levels. When we go to soybean inventories, the same graph, I'm going to use this graph a number of times today, we see that production, although we had a couple years in 07, 08, when production did not keep up with use, this year production's expected to far outstrip use. Now, this is contingent upon relatively large production occurring in South America this spring. Obviously, that is always a question mark. It's an interesting. I remember I started at OSU 8 years ago in 2001, and it seemed for the first 4 or 5 years that I was here every year when we talked about South America, we asked the question, geez, when will South America actually have a short crop? The last few years, it's really seemed like the opposite. Every year there's been a significant production shortfall for the last couple years, and so this year we're expecting that they'll have normal production, and if that's the case, it will be globally a record production year for soybeans. Oops, sorry, went ahead too. So now when we talk about ethanol, And there's basically, I want to move more precisely into corn. I want to start with biofuels and with ethanol. And what this chart is, it's a comparison of gasoline and ethanol prices. And when that blue line is high, when it's above the black line, that's when gasoline's cheaper than ethanol. So you can go back here, and at this peak right here, this is when gasoline cost about $1.50 less than ethanol. That's when MTBE was being phased out. There was a real shortage of ethanol temporarily right there during the spring and summer of 2006. We look at the summer of 2008 when gas prices, when we were up to $4 per gallon, and suddenly ethanol was $1 per gallon less than gasoline. Now, none of this includes the blender's tax credit. You include those, instead of being a dollar less, it's $1.50 less here. Instead of being $1.50 more, it's actually only 50 cents more. So just to put that in into perspective. But what we see now is ethanol is now once again cheaper than gasoline. And this is important because ethanol does deliver fewer miles to the gallon in cars, about, depending on the vehicle itself, 20 to 25% or 20 to 30% fewer miles to the gallon running E85 than gasoline. Now, this is important because consumers really honestly don't care about mileage or miles per gallon. They don't care that E85 gets fewer miles to the gallon. What they care about is miles per dollar. And so since ethanol, E85, delivers fewer miles per gallon, it needs to be sold at a discount for widespread penetration, even with the number of E85 vehicles that are out there. Very typical price differential. For example, right now, the gasoline station that's about a mile from my house here in Columbus, Ohio, has gasoline selling for about $2.50 and has E85 selling for about $2.30. That's simply not a big enough differential to justify the lower miles per gallon, the lower fuel mileage that you get. Now, as ethanol becomes cheaper and cheaper than gasoline, that differential should widen. Those of you, especially in the upper Midwest, you're going to have much wider differentials because you have much larger domestic capacity to produce ethanol and smaller capacity. We are an ethanol importing state. The Dakotas, Iowa, Minnesota are ethanol exporting states. So right now, overall, ethanol prices are about $1.55 to $1.60. Roughly, this is Chicago futures prices. They aren't a great indicator, but they give you a good idea as to where those prices are. So we take $1.60 ethanol. This green line right now is ethanol. If it's $1.60, these yellow lines give corn prices that correspond to it. At $1.60 ethanol, then corn prices that are $2.10 or below mean basically not building an ethanol plant becomes profitable to actually buy it and build it. $2.10 cash prices. Clearly, we're not in that area. Likewise, at $1.60 ethanol, if gas prices or if corn prices are above about $3.75 cash, it starts becoming harder and harder to justify continued operation of an ethanol plant. Now, this chart right here, I'm going through it kind of quickly. This chart is based upon an average ethanol plant. It starts with a spreadsheet that was actually published at University of Minnesota by Doug Tiffany and some other guys there. It's an excellent spreadsheet. I've made a couple little changes to it. But the big thing in this is that this is an average plant. And you know what they say about averages? Averages are wrong for everybody. So you can't just look at this spreadsheet and say, oh, well, cash prices are this. All plants are losing money. All plants aren't. Plants that are older, have older technology, or smaller, you can shift these curves up. Shift these curves down, the yellow curves down, it's harder for them to make money. Newer, larger plants with better logistics, you can shift these curves up. They can continue to buy corn for longer. But right now, we're in this in-between area where, depending upon the characteristics of the exact plant, they're going to continue generally to operate, but they're going to have, depending upon corn prices, it's going to be more challenging for them to actually make debt service payments, make those long-term payments. And so that's a intermediate issue. Right now, the latest data I've seen is that the United States is roughly 20% of our capacity is idle. In the United States, most of it tied up in bankruptcy. For example, in Ohio, we have 7 plants, 3 of which are not operating, 3 of which are tied up in bankruptcy right now. Those 3 plants represent roughly half of our capacity. And so the determination of when they come back online is simply how fast it moves through bankruptcy court. So when we look at that and convert this into bushels, right now ethanol consumption is moving up. We're expected to take about 4.2 billion bushels this year, continue to climb up to about 5.2 billion bushels 2 to 3 years from now. Okay, so another billion bushels of demand right now. Now, what's driving that? Well, this is the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007. This is all the mandates from that act. And what you have to realize is there's not a single mandate. I think if all of us sat down and tried to come up with the definition of renewable fuels, we could all sit down. I think last I looked, there were about 55 people on this webinar. And probably pretty quickly, we could come up with a nice definition for it. When our 535 elected representatives in Washington, D.C. sat down to define biofuels, this is what they came up with. 7 categories. Conventional biofuel, advanced biofuel, cellulosic biofuel, advanced non-cellulosic biofuel, biodiesel, and my favorite, advanced non-cellulosic, non-biodiesel biofuel. Each of these has separate mandates. Some of them are subcategories of the others. But when we talk about corn, this is really what we're talking about, this conventional biofuel. Right now, for this year, we're at a 10.5 billion gallon mandate. For calendar 2010, it's 12 billion gallon mandate. Now, the key thing to realize is right now we have built around, I believe, 12.5 to 13 billion gallons of capacity, and we have what is both built and under construction, about 15.1 billion gallons of capacity, all of which should be online at the latest by 2011. So this is going to be an easy mandate to meet. The big question is going to be, at what price does it take to sell more and more of these gallons? And I'm going to come back to that in a moment in the next slide. My curiosity much more, these advanced biofuels and cellulosic, starting in 2010 we have a cellulosic mandate. Starting in 2009 we have a biodiesel mandate. And especially this cellulosic, this 100 million gallons of cellulosic, I tend to call cellulosic ethanol tooth fairy ethanol because there are more people, I believe, in America that claim to have seen the tooth fairy than claim to have seen cellulosic ethanol produced at commercial scale. There's a lot of places where it can be produced at lab scale or pilot scale, but getting up to commercial scale production at anything approaching a reasonable price point so far is, it's really a fairy tale. And when we go over here to biodiesel, although we have more than enough capacity, I believe we have 800 to 900 million gallons of capacity of biodiesel. Right now that's operating at about 30 to 40% of capacity because the economics of biodiesel are so horrible. Simply put, when you want to make biodiesel out of vegetable oils or fats, you're really competing against human consumption directly, as opposed to corn ethanol, where you're competing against animals. So very different model. The key issue here, as I said, gasoline's now cheap, making ethanol quite cheap, and the problem is that the way that the EPA, I'm not going to go through this, I'm going to try and keep on time, I think I'm already behind, the way the EPA calculates this, basically, in 2009, 10.2% of all gasoline has to be ethanol of total gallons sold. Well, legally, you can only put 10% or 85%, 0 to 10 or 85% ethanol into gasoline. You can't run 10.2% or can't blend that legally under current EPA regulations. So that means basically, unless that E10 cap gets relaxed, the U.S. government's going to effectively be mandating that more and more gallons of E85 are sold. As we talked about before, to sell more and more of those gallons of E85, it has to be sold at a lower and lower price. So that means that there's a real difficult situation right now for the ethanol industry to sell more and more E85 at a lower and lower price, which creates tighter and tighter margins. Okay, so the ethanol industry, as we go forward, it's going to consume more bushels. That total consumption should increase by 800 million to a billion bushels in the next 2 years. It's going to be difficult to see how that profitability is maintained, and I think we're going to continue to see some bankruptcies here and there in that industry. Corn exports, this is a bright spot right now, not as strong certainly as 2 years ago, but as wheat availability's tightened up somewhat, as feed grain, other feed grain has tightened up, even in spite of the fact we have weaker global demand, we're still seeing more exports in 2009-10 than we did last year, which is quite a surprise. We look at overall feed use. This red line right here, this is total number of bushels going to feed use in the United States, and what you see is it peaked out in 05 at 6.1 billion bushels, has since declined to about 5.3 this year. The key thing, though, to realize is DGS has been playing a bigger and bigger role in feeding, and so while it looks like there's been about a 12% decline in feeding, in reality, since then, we've actually increased a little bit. We have decreased net from the 7 billion effective bushels 2 years ago down to 6.7, but we've not declined 13% over the last 5 years, like just looking at the corn number might indicate. So the overall corn situation right now, 12% stocks use. You look back, that is not a particularly tight number. That's not a scary number. This market gets nervous when those numbers go below 10%. We are above that. Production this year slated at 12.76 billion bushels. Use at 12.88 billion bushels. The question is, what is this production actually going to be? Obviously, a lot of questions about where yields end up. Most private forecasters are now looking at something closer to 13 billion bushels. I think this year, the way the weather has been through the Corn Belt, I think we're looking at a record yield. I'm expecting 162 to 164, something in that area, nationwide corn. If that happens, you're going to see this production move up another 250, 300 million bushels, and then you're going to see this stocks use, this ending inventory rise as well. My worry, I can come up very easily with a scenario that gets us at harvest cash prices far in the interior. So we're talking northwest Iowa, into the Dakotas, maybe Minnesota. I could see $2, $2.25 cash prices at harvest. Not sustained prices, not season average prices, but I think there is potentially a lot of downside risk here. There's obviously a lot of talk about frost and what frost could do. Key thing I would ask is, when is the last time a frost event has caused major yield damage over a broad area? Not that recently. You may have frost events that may cost a few bushels in very restricted areas, but it really needs to stretch far down into Iowa and Nebraska in order to have any significant impact, I believe, on U.S. national production. I think the odds of that are quite low when we look at historical trends. So really, it's about as bad as it can get for corn prices. Nothing's going right. We've got higher acreage, each of the estimates that have come out, lots of carry-in, exports stronger than last year, but still not great. With this cool summer we've had, I think we're going to be swimming in corn. There's going to be some big piles of corns across the Corn Belt. This isn't region specific, across the Corn Belt. Throw on top of that, oil prices relatively weak compared to a year ago, means it's taken a lot of the steam out of ethanol. That's weakened support for corn. And then just continuing uncertainty in that ethanol industry with 20% idle capacity, and yet another 30%, that capacity is going to expand by about 30% in the next 2 years. So really right now, a lot of things looking very negative for the U.S. corn industry. When we look at soybeans, domestic demand is steady, up slightly over this year. I think the real question is, as we go forward, and especially into next year, as very weak margins in the livestock industry, especially dairy, but really across the livestock industry. What's that going to do to meal demand? These guys are bleeding money. How much longer? And meal prices, although they've come down, certainly have not come down as quick as other commodity prices. Exports have really been the brightest spot across any commodity. We're on track right now for another record year of exports, 9-10. We'll see what happens with South American production in the spring. But clearly, the world's insatiable demand for soybeans and high-quality soybeans has not appeared to slow down. Overall, we look at soybean inventories. Moderately tight. The 7% number, when we look historically, is on the tighter side. It's below average. Not tight enough to make the market crazy like the 4% in the old crop that had all the uncertainty last year, but still low enough that any sort of hint, if we do get frost this year, soybean markets are going to move much more to it, react much more than corn will. Overall, production higher than use. Can spare a few bushels before things get crazy. So I think we will see some continued weakness in soybeans as we move into new crop. I think old crop has provided a lot of that support. The gray line in back is all wheat inventories. This is just like the previous graph. I've just omitted production and omitted that production and use numbers. This gray line in back is all wheat. The red is soft red that we use we grow in the Eastern Corn Belt. There's all wheat inventories continuing to rise, more and more wheat becoming available in the U.S., driven to a large extent by increased soft red inventories. These are just these percentage inventories. A farmer here that grows a lot of soft red that I talk to a lot has begun calling, he's oftentimes refers to soft red as America's feed wheat, and that's really what's happened. It's picked up a lot of acres. The basis has really become very squirrely in this. Does that mean I need to stop for questions real quick? I didn't catch that. I just got that message. Sorry.
Keep going.
No, okay. You're fine. Keep going.
Okay. So, so when we look at wheat, wheat's becoming plentiful. The reality is right now, market-wide, I'll be honest, I don't see much reason to be bullish about these markets. I think the best thing that I can say is soybean exports have been strong, and nitrogen has come down an awful lot in the past 12 months, obviously. When we start talking about management, I'm going to leave it to the guys next week to talk about risk management. But I think that this is going to be a year, as you move through harvest, to start thinking to yourself, okay, I think, how would I, if I had 09, if I had 08, 09 to do over again, how would I have marketed in hindsight? Because I think we are shaping up for another year in which it will be very easy with average yields, very easy to lose money because we don't have that safety net directly below our cost of production that guarantees sort of break even. This is going to be a year in which one can easily again see prices falling from February to harvest. And so I think it's going to be a critical year in which we ask, gee, how do we respond? I think it's very easy to come up with a scenario. I'm not forecasting this, but come up with a scenario in 9-10 that we have average, or 10-11, that we have average corn prices of 250 to 260, average cash corn prices. I don't think, I would not be at all surprised by that. Again, that's lower than what I expect. I expect a 3 to 325, but lower than that's easy to come to. And if we get to those prices with the rents that are out there, with the land that is out there, and still, even as nitrogen and other fertilizers have come down, those are still prices. It's going to be very hard to justify growing crops. You know, that's going to push land, we would expect, into beans and into wheat. Those markets don't have the demand structure to absorb more acres either. So overall, I think this is going to be a year where guys need to think about what does profit mean, and really work on managing their risk, managing that profit risk. So really quickly, I'm just going to go through. I have a lot more slides here. If anybody's on this wants to ask some questions later or follow up with emails later, the cap and trade bill is something I think people need to understand, growers need to understand better than they do. There's a couple points I want you to take away, and then I'm going to skip a lot of the details. The first is the Environmental Protection Agency now has been given the authority under the Clean Air Act. They have the authority, and based upon last year's Supreme Court ruling, they now have the mandate to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. Okay, so this climate change bill that's working its way through Congress, it is not, there's a lot of talk out in the country that, gee, if that's defeated, we're fine. If that bill is defeated, the EPA has the mandate to step in and unilaterally impose greenhouse gas regulation. Waxman-Markey, this greenhouse gas bill is an attempt to have these regulations made by legislators instead of regulators, instead of the EPA. Now, a farmer I was talking to last week came up and said, well, this just sort of sounds like we have the choice between handing the loaded gun to a four-year-old or a six-year-old. I said, well, you know, that's true. I think a better one is the four-year-old's handing it. We have the choice to either leave it with the four-year-old or take it away and hand it to the six-year-old. And that's literally what this is. So we need to remember when we talk about, when ag lobbies talk about defeating this bill, that doesn't mean this goes away. It means the EPA will do it unilaterally. The ag portion of this bill was very rushed. There was nothing regarding ag in the committee bill. It was all added on the floor. This bill gets passed, you will see higher fuel prices, eventually higher fertilizer prices, higher electricity, probably going to be relatively small, on the order of 5 to 15%. However, this bill will create the opportunity for farmers to basically sell permits to industries to emit more carbon. It's going to be through no reduced tillage, biodigestion, cover crops. I think that for most crops, most row crops, this will more than offset, those offsets will more than offset the higher input costs. But it's going to be different. CAFOs, I think, are actually the big winners here. CAFOs that can put in anaerobic digesters have the potential, I think, to really do very well under this legislation. Other crops, cotton, rice especially, will do very poorly. They don't have as much opportunity to go to no-till or other carbon-reduced production practices, and they are fertilizer intensive. So I'll let you guys read that later. The slides are all up. The devil's in the details of all this bill. It can come out written very favorable to ag or very unfavorable. I think it will have to be favorable in order to pass, but there's some big questions here. Additionality, in other words, if you're already no-tilling, do you still get to sell credits? When we talk about no-till, we really are talking about not much till. The EPA, when they talk about no-till, they're talking about never-till. What's it going to take to get farmers to never-till? What's the complexity of this program going to look like? I mean, look at Acre sign-up. Acre was a no-brainer by the time sign-up closed, yet we still have relatively low sign-ups for it. So imagine trying to get farmers to sign up for a program like this. So with that, let's go to questions.
Okay, Matt, thank you. And for our team, we're going to ask, I got one question here for Matt at this point, and I'd like to bring the polling, a couple of polling questions up while we do that and transition over to Jim Robb's presentation. But Matt, a lot of information there, really powerful information. Do you... As you look at that, and you made some really good information about energy, do you see any, what are the possibilities for a decoupling of corn prices and energy prices at some point here in the future?
That's a great question. I don't see any reason that they should decouple. I think after that corn mandate tops out in another couple years, in other words, we get to 15 billion gallons of production, we will probably see the correlation weaken, so the coupling won't be quite as tight. But fundamentally, I would argue what is driving this, is really the fact that there is fundamentally energy in corn. And when we had $2 corn and $20 per barrel oil, it wasn't worth extracting that energy from the corn. Now that we have $70 per barrel oil, which I think is kind of permanent, I think we're kind of in an era of higher oil prices. That's a talk unto itself. It is much easier to extract economically that energy from the corn. So now, clearly government policy has helped that. I still assert, even if we didn't have government policy, we would still have a sizable ethanol industry in this country.
And as we're, one last question, as we're going up to Jim Robb's presentation, what's your expectation about corn acres, and will they decline?
Another great question. Over time, I think that corn acres from where we are now will continue to see a few million acre change year to year. I don't believe we will see a systematic decline in corn acres for the next 5 to 10 years. Now, what the uncertain parts there, obviously, you got a lot of guys talking about by 2015 we're going to have 180, 190 bushel national yields, and we've got drought resistant corn and all this sort of stuff. I'll wait and believe it when I see how it does in the fields. That clearly would free up some acres, but no, I don't fundamentally see a reason that for corn acres to significantly decline. I think it'll be year to year based upon relative prices and rotations.
Thank you very much. Hang around so that we'll have a chance to ask another question or two at the end. But